time for Wisconsin life. Wisconsin's calendar is filled year-round with Lutheran lutefisk dinners, Catholic fish fries, and other church-sponsored meals. These events serve as fundraisers and as carriers of community identity and tradition. John Hildebrand explains why we like paying money to stand in line at these meals.
On a cold night in January, the head cook ducks out of the kitchen to assess the crowd lined up in the school cafeteria. If the line ends at the double doors, all is well. But if it snakes out the doors and past the low-set water fountain to the coat racks in the hallway, he'll need to add another 60 pounds of Alaskan pollock to the pot. "Father," says the cook, jogging back to the kitchen, "I don't mean to rush you, but we could really use some more fish." Reverend Eugene Klink bends over the cafeteria sink in the same posture I've seen him bent over the altar during the offertory, and for somewhat the same purpose, to feed the multitude. He thaws the frozen fish into lymph fillets that go into a boiling cauldron, along with a basket of peeled onions and another of red potatoes. 3 minutes later, when the cook and his assistants hoist the steaming baskets from the cauldron, a heat wave runs through the room as if the kitchen had suddenly crash-landed in some equatorial jungle where the ambient temperature was 100 degrees and the air smelled heavy with garlic, onions, and oregano. For 20 years, Immaculate Conception Parish has held a New England-style fish boil every other Friday night between the end of January and Easter, a six-week period which roughly coincides with Lent, that gray season of self-denial and giving up. But it's hard to see what patrons of the fish boil give up except cooking for the night. What they get, besides fish, potatoes, carrots, coleslaw, and a little ice cream cup, is a break from winter doldrums. It's a chance to mingle with strangers and to relive that thrilling moment from childhood when you look up from your lunch tray and wonder where to sit. I'd come the night before the fish boiled, help with preparations. 300 pounds of carrots and potatoes, 200 pounds of onions. The men gravitated towards the onions, cutting them at arm's length, while the women peeled the carrots with a motion like dealing cards. As they worked, the women compared notes on the competition. Fish suppers offered at neighboring parishes. "Those others," said a carrot peeler, "are deep fried." Most often, I work the fish boil as a dishwasher, the kitchen equivalent of playing left field, because there's little pressure and plenty of time to look around. The other volunteers are people I see the rest of the year only in their professional guises, and it's reassuring to see them in a different uniform. Priest, salesman, dentist, all of us wearing the same plastic apron with a paper name tag. Only the cook crew are set apart by their pinstripe cloth aprons and no name tag, because everyone knows who they are. As the customers trickle down towards the end of the evening, the cook retrieves a few cans of beer that have been cooling in the walk-in freezer for just this moment. The beer is passed from one volunteer to another to become the unspoken grace after the meal.
John Hildebrand is the author of several books, including his most recent, The Heart of Things, a Midwestern Almanac. Wisconsin Life is produced by Erica Janik. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television. For more information, visit wisconsinlife.org.
Well, born from those church basements and community gatherings, the Community Cookbook was an early form of social networking.
Before the giant full-color cookbooks we see today, Americans relied on simple, handwritten collections of tried-and-true recipes passed down from generations.
To talk about the history of community cookbooks, we're joined by Tracy Nathans-Kelly, a culinary historian at Cornell University. Tracy, thanks a lot for joining us.
It's going to be great fun to talk to you. Thanks for having me in.
Well, I've seen these community cookbooks. I've had a few. I think anybody's grandparent probably has a collection of them. But how did these community cookbooks first start circulating?
As far as we've been able to tell, those of us who have been kind of hunting backwards on the history of these things, there were a few that came out around the Civil War era, and they were first produced to raise money for bandages and other needs for the wars. And so churches and other community groups would put out these very low-end little recipe collections in order to raise what money they could to support their soldiers.
And what do you think we can learn about a particular community or region by looking at their cookbooks?
It's one of my favorite things to do is to hunt backwards once we see one of these community cookbooks. So I first became interested in them when I lived in northern North Dakota. And I would pick up the local cookbooks there because, well, they were everywhere, right? They were at the thrift stores and they were in the used bookstores and wonderful recipes. And I started to look very closely at the women that were in them and how they portrayed their food. What I noticed is often the desserts, the cakes, the pies, all the yummy things make up the bulk of these recipes. and that makes sense because baking is more of a science than maybe slow cooking or doing a roast, right? You have to have all your measurements correct. But there would be these intriguing moments where we would see almost the same cake recipe over and over and over again inside one of these collected cookbooks, maybe from a church or something. They'd be very similar. So it was obviously a popular cake or dish at that time. Other times when I would see very old ones, perhaps, all of a sudden, if I had several in a row from the same organization, I would see canned salmon start to show up in a lot of these recipes. Well, obviously, canned salmon was now available on the shelf. And so it marked not only food trends, but also quite early availability of certain foodstuffs that may be in or out of vogue or in and out of availability, if you will.
Well, you can kind of do a culinary archaeology there in a way. And do you see maybe a shifting ethnic traditions as well when you look at a region over time?
Absolutely. In fact, some of my favorite cookbooks from North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, Minnesota make very strong efforts in documenting their heritage. I want to say, I'm not at home, so I don't have my bookshelf right in front of me. I want to say that from Wisconsin in particular, there is a cookbook that divides out its recipes not by dinners, side dishes, cakes, and so forth. Rather, the delineations are by ethnic groups. So we'll see Luxembourgers, of all things, right? German, Native American recipes. So they divide out by the ethnic heritage. And so you would go to that section if you wanted some lutefisk. Well, you would know right where to go, to the Norwegian section. And so it was a very concerted effort to bring forth all of these special dishes that needed to be documented, saved, recorded, archived for their communities.
Now, obviously, it's a lot. It's very telling about history to look at these cookbooks, but how do the recipes themselves stack up over the years?
One of my best recipes is from an Immaculate Conception Lutheran cookbook that I have. It's got a nice yellow cover that's got lots of stains on it. It's for cocktail meatballs. These recipes are fantastic because you would only put your best recipes out there for the public to see.
Now, these are coming at a time, a lot of them, I imagine, before women were voting in this country, before women were represented in media or the publishing industry. Were these a big deal in you know, a voice and a creative outlet, I guess, for women?
I think that they were. I think if you would have asked them at the time if that's what it was, they would have denied it, right? It wasn't seen quite in that light, but it absolutely was. And what's part of that archaeology we were talking about a couple minutes ago is when you open these books, pay attention to how the women are representing themselves. So in early days, we would often see them go by their husband's name. So, you know, Mrs. David Peterson instead of Alice Peterson, or even, you know, going by their maiden name. And every now and again, you will see somebody represented in those books without their marriage title with them, or obviously with still their maiden name, and that would indicate not married or perhaps widowed or something else, right? Sometimes it takes a little bit of investigation. And other books, you'll see quite a mix of how women represent themselves to the outside world. The ones that I love and that are very rare are when women include pictures of themselves. And so one of my favorite cookbooks is out of a small town in North Dakota, and just a little stapled thing put together, probably 40 pages. Every single picture is dedicated to one woman, Her picture is large and beautiful. There's a little short biography of her, sometimes autobiography if she's still alive, and then her one best recipe. And that is an absolute treasure. What's funny in that one, though, is that there are no men pictured. So if it's an anniversary photo, they've lopped the men off of that picture. It was decidedly a book about the women. And sometimes you would see their kids or grandkids, but not the husbands. It wasn't their turn.
That's such a personal approach.
Yes.
Well, you mentioned the cocktail. I think it was meatballs from that recipe that is one of your favorites now. Do you have other favorite recipes as you go over and you look at some of these community cookbooks?
Well, you know, I take a hankering to them. Well, what's terrible is you start cooking all these things, right? And you kind of have to watch your waistline a little bit. There's another, incidentally, meatball recipe that Joan Peterson, right there in Madison, brought to my attention called porcupine meatballs. I'm sure a lot of our listeners know what that is. And so I've tried lots of different versions of that. That recipe is amazing.
What's a porcupine meatball?
Yeah. It's basically a meatball, a little bit wetter than usual, but you would roll it in instant rice and then cook it with the sauce. And so the rice kind of sticks to the meatball, but it also cooks and plumps up, so it looks like a little porcupine, if you do it right. there's wonderful recipes for very fancy fruit salads, which, of course, in the dead of winter, canned fruit and coconut and whipped cream, these were fantastically beautiful desserts that you would take to these church dinners that we were just hearing about.
Oh, they sound delicious. Tracy, thank you so much for joining us and sharing this with us.
Anytime.
We've been speaking with Tracy Nathans-Kelly. She's a culinary historian at Cornell University.